Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll learn about a new library that's opened up shop in downtown Fresno that's aimed squarely at kids. But they aren't lending out just books and videos. This library is all about toys. We'll find out what that means for area families. We'll also talk to Bill McEwen, formerly of the Fresno Bee. For 37 years, he has a new job with GV Wire. We'll find out what that means and talk some local politics. Plus, violinist Patrick Contreras joins us to talk about an upcoming show he has and a new musical project, a new band as well. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but first we begin with our ongoing series about healthcare. As we reported earlier this summer, the Fresno area could soon be home to two new medical schools. While that may seem like a great opportunity for creating homegrown doctors, research suggests local residencies and fellowships could be even more important for keeping doctors here. But the Valley lags behind the state in those training opportunities, too. FM 89's Carrie Klein explains how local health leaders are working hard to expand those positions, despite a 20-year-old federal law that puts a limit on funding for medical training.
Community Regional Medical Center in downtown Fresno is a teaching hospital. Residents from UCSF Fresno go there for clinical hours in fields like family medicine, gastroenterology, and psychiatry. They also come for skills training.
So you can either use a knife, or what is your other option?
A needle.
A needle or...
Today, dozens of residents and scrubs are poking instruments into pig tracheas, which look just as gross as you'd expect, but double as human airways for these emergency medicine residents. Dr. Andres Anaya is a third-year resident and one of the lab's instructors. He's all in on emergency medicine.
Because it's rad. It's perfect for people with my personality, which is... I like to see a lot of variety and a lot of different things.
In this room full of doctors from around the country, Anaya's a local boy.
I was born and raised here in Fresno. I was actually born in this hospital.
Anaya studied in San Jose and San Francisco, but his plan was always to come back here.
There's a huge need here in the Valley for trained, qualified doctors, and all of my family is here. So this is where I feel like I can contribute the most and also be close to my family.
This is exactly what UCSF Fresno wants to hear. Dr. Michael Peterson is the school's chief of medicine and associate dean.
Since our goal here is to produce physicians that are going to provide care in the Central Valley to address the issue of the physician shortage, we want to do everything we can to make sure that we're bringing people in that we can predict are going to stay in the region.
Janet Kaufman is a professor of health policy at UC San Francisco. She says one predictor of where doctors practice is where they grew up, but...
One of the biggest drivers is where physicians are trained.
Studies have shown around half of doctors practice not where they went to medical school, but where they completed their graduate training in programs like residencies and fellowships.
Some of that is just when people are coming out of residency, they're often early to mid-30s. And, you know, they're at a stage where, you know, they're ready to be a little more settled.
Here in the Valley, we have slots for about 750 residents and fellows. That may sound like a lot, but per capita, our share of residents is lower than the state average and far below California's biggest metropolitan areas. LA County alone has 4,000 residents. But beefing up our graduate medical programs isn't easy. A 20-year-old federal law actually limits how much the government will pay hospitals to train residents. So why would the government want to limit medical education? It all hinges on the Medicare program, which funds the lion's share of graduate medical training. To understand what happened, let's look back at the economic landscape of the late 1990s.
In a few moments, I will sign into law the first balanced budget in a generation.
For over a decade before Bill Clinton announced the Balanced Budget Act of 1997, Medicare costs had been rising. At the same time, there was no national doctor shortage. In fact, thanks to the expansion of managed care, researchers were predicting a surplus of doctors. Karen Fisher with the American Association of Medical Colleges says, at that time, limiting residency programs through the Balanced Budget Act seemed like a painless way to slash Medicare spending.
Obviously, that didn't turn out to be the case. Managed care had a major backlash against it. The population started to get older, et cetera, and we started to see, not long after 97, probably in the early to mid-2000s, shortages starting to emerge.
The act worked by telling teaching hospitals, however many residents you trained last year, that's now your residency cap. That's all Medicare will help you pay for.
And so depending on what the hospital was training in 1996, that amount essentially was frozen and continues to be frozen today.
There are some exceptions. Teaching hospitals in rural areas have slightly higher caps, and two specialties have no caps at all. Also, the cap applies only to hospitals, not to clinics or other health centers. Still, in the Valley, 90% of residency slots are in teaching hospitals, because that's where the infrastructure is. Stephen Schilling, the Bakersfield-based CEO of Clinica Sierra Vista, says it's just not enough.
The traditional medical education programs have been complaining for decades that the cap and the funding formulas that come through the Medicare program have been massively inadequate to build the workforce that this country needs.
Since 2009, lawmakers across the country have tried to appropriate money for more residents. H.R. 2267, a House bill introduced earlier this year, proposes to raise the cap by 15,000 residents. One co-sponsor is Representative Ruben Kiwen of Nevada, a state that also struggles with physician access.
This is a desperately needed bill that would help us expand the amount of residencies, not only in the state of Nevada, but across the country. So this is going to save us money in the long term, and it's something that it's long overdue.
Lawmakers have another year to move on the two bills, which no Valley legislators have yet co-sponsored. In 2015, an earlier version of the House bill earned close to 150 co-sponsors from both sides of the aisle, but it never came to a vote. In the meantime, regions like ours do have options. Training programs can find alternative funding sources, and non-teaching hospitals can start new programs. If they do that and seek Medicare funding, they have 5 years before they reach their own caps. And it's looking like that will happen. New programs at St. Agnes Medical Center in Fresno, Madera Community Hospital, and Valley Children's Hospital in Madera could add more than 160 new residents to the Valley. Plus, in 2010, the Affordable Care Act established a new class of program called Teaching Health Centers. The Valley's three centers in Fresno, Bakersfield, and Modesto have brought 66 residents into underserved areas. A handful of bills currently in Congress, some supported by local Congressman Jeff Denham and David Valadeo, aim to renew the program's funding beyond its sunset next month. As for Andres Anaya, his background and his choice of residency are keeping him around.
I'll be right here in the Valley. That's for sure. I'm not going anywhere.
He's still looking for a job when he finishes next year, but to start, he's worked out a volunteer position with a local SWAT team. He also plans to get involved with UCSF Fresno's Doctors Academy, which aims to spark interest in medicine in kids as early as middle school. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Carrie Klein.
And this report is a project of the USC Annenberg California Health Journalism Fellowship. You can find more reports in our series Struggling for Care on our website at kvpr.org, and also find out how you can submit your story about your struggles with the doctor shortage. This is Valley Edition. Two Fresno agencies are teaming up to help prepare some of the Valley's youngest children for school. A free early childhood education program is up and running at a restored classic home in downtown Fresno. Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess reports the home also includes a library, but it's lending out something you might not expect.
Rebecca Lara plays with her three-year-old son Julian at the Helm Home in downtown Fresno. The 116-year-old Mission Revival-style home, sometimes called the Alamo House because of its distinctive shape, is the site of the Fresno Unified School District's Starting Smart and Strong initiative. Parents like Laura have been bringing their children, some as young as infants, to the home to play with them and learn how to prepare their children for school.
Because it helps them before they start school. It teaches them how to play with other kids and everything.
The home was renovated and is owned by the Fresno Housing Authority, which is letting FUSD use it rent-free. The thinking by the district and the authority is that by reaching kids at the youngest ages and teaching non-professional caregivers how to turn play into learning, the children will be better prepared for school. To achieve this goal, the house has a unique feature, a toy lending library.
We have the babies first, then, so you hear, here's like, and you'll be able to hear.
Maria Cabellos picks up a neatly labeled plastic box from a shelf containing row after row of similar boxes, packed with all manner of toys. Cabellos, who supervises the program, says parents who sign up are free to borrow a toy and take it home for up to 2 weeks, just like a library of books. That way, they can take the skills they're learning in the program back home.
The kids might be very focused on using, for example, Let's Go Fishing playset. And they're using it during the play group, and they really like it, that the learning and the play doesn't stop there, that they get to continue with that learning and that play at home when they just come to the a lending library and they check out that specific toy.
Cabello says it's become increasingly clear to the district they're waiting too long to try and get kids up to speed when they get to school. This program, which is funded by the Packard Foundation, is one effort to make sure even kids whose parents can't afford professional childcare can have access to the best practices for preparing their children for school.
When I used to work with older children, with families, and I always felt that we were providing a lot of programs for intervention. But it was like when they were older, when they needed that additional support. We want to start early, creating more of that prevention approach.
Jose Zalapa is the main program coordinator at Helm Home. He says he was surprised to find out how many parents did not realize that children playing is an important part of early learning.
I've been hearing a while ago that why do we need to play with a kid? They're little. They don't understand. An infant, a toddler. A two-year-old, they don't understand. Just when they get to preschool or kindergarten, they will learn, and that's not the case.
That's been exactly the experience of Rebecca Lara, who's taken advantage of the toy lending library to take her son's favorite toys home for more learning.
The blocks, like the builder blocks that you put together in the alphabet ones, and he knows all the pictures and stuff on them. And he took some books home that I read to him.
What did that mean for you?
It felt good and everything that I could take the books home.
In addition to toys, the library has books for children, but also for adults. Books on English learning, child development, and GED prep. Cabello says they know the more than 80 kids that are enrolled in the first year often come from low-income families, where finding money for toys sometimes isn't the most pressing need.
The toys is the last thing that they have in their mind. And I mean, I completely respect that. Like, there's other priorities that they have to take in consideration first before purchasing the toys. So that's what we have here, that they're able to come and use and then just bring back.
But what does the Housing Authority, which is tasked with finding safe and affordable housing, get out of getting involved in early childhood education? Executive Director Preston Prince says FUSD came to them looking for a partnership to help the roughly 19,000 kids in FHA housing that attend the district.
How do we leverage the time at home to make sure that they do well at school? That if it's about readiness, attendance, extended learning environment, those are kind of the three precepts for grade level reading by third grade, that those are all areas that we play a pretty big role as a housing authority.
The program is free and open to the public. Prince says this is not the only time they've teamed up with school districts, such as a healthcare initiative in Fowler, and pre-K outreach in Fireball. The Housing Authority does not charge FUSD any rent, but the district does pay utility costs out of the grant money that enabled them to start the toy lending library in the first place.
It's high the way
say teddy bear and turtle.
But of course, for three-year-old Julian, it's all about the dinosaurs and Play-Doh. For Valley Public Radio News, I'm Jeffrey Hess.
This is Valley Edition. He's a familiar name and voice to many in the San Joaquin Valley, but you'll no longer see Bill McEwen's name in the Fresno Bee as editorial board editor. Earlier this month, the longtime reporter, columnist, and editor retired after 37 years with the Bee. He's not the only local name to walk away from the newspaper industry recently. The Bakersfield Californian's Lois Henry retired last week after 30 years with the paper. But while Henry has accepted a job representing local businesses through a nonprofit organization, McEwen is still in the news media, accepting a job with a news website run by Fresno-based housing developer Granville Homes, known as GVWire.com. Bill joins us now on Valley Edition. Bill, welcome.
Thanks for having me on today.
What's your new role going to be with GV Wire? This is a relatively new publication. What are you going to be doing there?
Well, so I've joined the team, and all together there will be four of us involved, and we will not be doing daily news stories. Our goal is to have an impact on public policy that will result in a better situation for people in the Valley and throughout the state of California. Video is a big part of what we do, and next week we're going to have a top-notch videographer join our team. In addition, I'll be writing a couple columns a week. We'll start posting editorials, and I think I'll be the person writing those editorials as well. So,
a couple of years ago, you almost left the paper to take a job with Jim Costa as his district director, but you backed out there. Was it tough to leave this time? It's certainly a challenging industry right now.
Well, it is a challenge. It was easier to make the decision this time. And part of that is just if you're putting out a newspaper, you also have a digital website. You know that your website is your future. And in a chain such as McClatchy's, there's tremendous pressure on everyone in the room to produce daily page views. And I didn't like the direction that we were going as far as the kind of stories that we were doing. For a long time, people say about television news, if it bleeds, it leads. And to me, the Bee was, you know, a lot of resources were being spent going after crime news that while it's interesting and people want to read about it, I mean, it's proven by the numbers, I don't think that it's going to have an impact on policy or on decision makers.
Now, before we go any further, I should disclose that Granville Homes, the publisher of GV Wire, is also a corporate sponsor of this station. In fact, this News Talk studio that we're broadcasting from was funded in part with their support. With, as you mentioned, the for-profit media business, it's not just newspapers, but media in general struggling. Why does Granville Homes want to get into the news business?
So I don't know that you could say we want to get into the news business because at this juncture, it is a nonprofit endeavor. That doesn't close the door to the future to making it into a for-profit venture, but we're free really to chase the stories that we think are important to the community, and that's very appealing.
Now, you have a video that's out on Facebook talking about your role with the publication and what you're going to be doing. You start out in front of Fresno City Hall. Granville is a major player in Fresno development, also Fresno politics. Granville's Vice President Jeff Roberts is one of the most familiar faces you'll see at City Hall meetings almost every time, at least I'm there. How are you going to cover stories that inevitably have some intersection with public policy, but also what Granville Homes is doing?
So I think I stated it very clearly in my column. And obviously, when people heard that I was going to Granville, they started criticizing me and saying there's this huge conflict of interest. Darius Assemi and I had long conversations about this. And as I say in the column, when it comes to the news operation, the buck stops with me. My opinions in my columns will be my own. Darius Assemi writes columns. Obviously, those opinions will be his own. And then finally, the editorials. The situation will be no different than any newspaper in America or any website in America, in that the editorial is the institutional voice of the publication. And so that'll be GV Wire's view when you see the editorial.
Do you think there's an opportunity, not specifically with GV Wire, but looking at journalism overall and what's happening to the newspaper industry, and you have upstarts like GV Wire, also the Central Valley Observer, your former Bee reporter George Hostetter now writes there. It seems like there's disruption. Sometimes that can be a negative. And in fact, we've seen so many jobs eliminated. I think it would be hard to argue against that or argue that that's a positive. But do you think there's an opportunity here for a new journalism to emerge in some way?
Well, sure, because, you know, media is splintered and everybody's looking for their niche. And I call viewers, if you're going to a digital website, you're a viewer and a reader. And those people are making decisions every day about which websites they go, and they're looking for their niche. But, you know, you look at the serious journalism being done in California, and you look at Cal Matters, which is a nonprofit website, and Dan Walters went to work for them. Obviously, he knows as much about the legislature and the governor's office in California as anybody. So that's a good thing. And also with like Cal Matters, they can take the time. They're not worried about the daily story. They take the big view. They take the information from this accumulation of daily stories, and then they say, hey, where's California going? Or what are possible solutions to this? And once they identify the solutions, then they say, what are the roadblocks? And typically that gets you into the pig trough that is politics.
One of the laments that I've heard in talking not just about your departure, but just in general, and we've seen this with the Californian and other media organizations, even nationally to some degree with NPR a few years ago when they had national cutbacks in Washington, the loss of institutional memory. Is that something that worries you about the future of some of the more legacy media organizations that are out there? You had been with the paper 37 years. Lois Henry had been with the Californian 30 years, and we'd love to have her on our program to talk about this as well. But there's a lot of institutional memory of you know what the local politics is and was. Is that something that is at risk?
I don't know that it's at risk because there are always young reporters that come aboard and they do an excellent job and they're very talented and they'll take on that role. This continues over time. That's why we have archives. We have fantastic search engines in which we can look at anything that's ever been in a publication. So it's a matter of when you talk about the collective memory, is someone willing to really research that? And even though I'm at GV Wire, if there's anybody in the media that's doing a story and they want to know, quote unquote, where the bodies are buried or what happened, they can give me a call. And hopefully my memory is still sharp on that, but I can point them in the right direction. And Joe, you raised the name Lois Henry, and Lois, outstanding reporter and outstanding columnist, and knows as much about how water plays such a huge role in the valley as anybody. And I wish Lois well in her next endeavor as well.
Speaking of where the bodies are buried, I want to move on to some of the actual politics that's going on in our community right now. Is Brooke Ashton the dog who chased the car, caught the car, and now is in a bit of a pickle himself? He was the staunchest opponent of Superintendent Michael Hansen, facilitated his departure from the district earlier this year. Now he is in his own hot water with his anti-LGBT comments that were in the Bee and other legal issues that have popped up. We hear he has political ambition beyond the school board, at least that's the scuttlebutt out there in the community. Did those dreams die this month, or in the era of Trump, is being uncouth a political virtue?
Well, Brooke, if you follow his Twitter feed, he admires President Trump. He likes that rough and tumble politics, and he has that, fighter mentality. I think that's one of, it can be a strength, because obviously you had to be strong to more or less depose Michael Hansen as superintendent. Michael Hansen was backed by the people that run this community and the leading political figures. And it seemed like no matter what was revealed about this leaseback situation and how the superintendent royally screwed that up, people were going to stand by him. And then when you started to look at the numbers, because Superintendent Hansen had always said, well, I'm moving the district forward. Progress is not as fast as people would like, but remember, it was a mess. So it took me 4 or 5 years to get everything organized, to get the trains to run on time and that kind of thing. And then, you know, the numbers we've seen, the true numbers about academic performance that came out in the last 6 months or so showed that district had made no progress at all. So if you weren't a fighter like Brooke Ashton, Mike Hansen would still be superintendent. The flip side of that is he's not a statesman. And, you know, the irony in his comments, because he made such strong personal comments, almost totally overlooked is the fact that he said, hey, the law's the law, and I'll support the law. So,
and isn't that his argument?
Yeah, it's his argument, but no one's really talking about it. And the other thing is, I don't know where this came from, that he has these political ambitions, because, and I've talked to him frequently, I've interviewed him frequently, he's never expressed that ambition. And in fact, he's expressed a lot of ambivalence about even taking this on. And I think basically he saw a problem. He's got a soft spot for children and for the underdog and people that face hard consequences. I mean, you know, the work he did with the Marjorie Mason Center was extraordinary, and a lot of people don't know about it. So I've seen Brooke basically cry at the drop of the hat. I know a lot of people wouldn't believe that, but he can be very emotional. I don't think he'll run for future office at all.
Does he fill out the rest of his term, if you were a betting person?
If I were a betting person, he's not. He would not announce it, because then he'd be a lame duck and he'd be seen as weak. So, you know, it's that warrior mentality again. We'll see what happens, you know, going into late next year.
Speaking of politicians who are on the aggressive side, at least recently, Councilmember Gary Bredefeld has really been in the news a lot with a number of initiatives that he has proposed. Of course, the In God We Trust initiative that wound up successful, in fact, is now on the back wall behind the dais at City Hall. His effort to allow city employees to carry guns, his effort to ban the cultivation of marijuana in the city, less successful. Has he eclipsed Steve Brandow in being the most aggressive conservative voice on the council? And has Brandow maybe eclipsed him as being a more effective voice, at least in terms of getting his policies in law?
Well, right now, Steve Brandow's a more effective council member because he has good relationships with other members of the council. And whatever Steve has done, even when he's been on the extreme, he's always kept the door open. He's an excellent communicator, and I've never doubted his sincerity about what he proposes. With Gary Bredefeld, I'm shocked. The B editorial board recommended him for election. A lot of that was based on his performance years ago when he was a city council member, and I don't recognize Gary Bredefeld today. I mean,
how has he changed?
Well, he used to be what I would call a Rockefeller Republican, in that, you know, very pro-business, but also compassionate. And I think about, you know, how he stood up for the people of his district when development was proposed that, you know, would have a lot of impacts. And he would describe his position very eloquently and say, hey, I'm all for business, I'm all for more jobs, I'm for hiring, but we have to include the neighborhood in the conversation, and we have to mitigate the impacts. And, you know, there's more to life than simply growing. This is the thing he used to say, it's about the quality of life that you grow. So I think about how he was for the downtown stadium and an important part of getting that stadium built, and really sticking with it through thick and thin, and ultimately being successful. Today, He just looks like a talking points politician to me, anything to get attention. And I don't see, I don't see the rationale behind a lot of what he does. And in addition, if you represent District 6, which is the wealthiest part of Fresno, traditionally the person that represents 6 has taken a leadership role and, tried to bring sides together and trying to find ways to get solutions to pressing problems, like, yes, we all want more parks, but how are we going to fund it? Yes, we want more police officers, but right now we're having a hard time retaining police officers and recruiting new ones. Where is the thought pattern on that? Instead, it's, we got to pass in God we trust, something that is symbolic, and that symbolism is important to a large part of the Fresno community, but at the same time, doesn't do anything to move the city forward. And I'm like the guy who says, what is it, Joe? In God we trust, all others pay cash.
Before we go, we've got a couple of minutes here. AB 1250, this is generating a lot of controversy. Before you left the Bee, you penned an editorial that was highly critical of this bill that would make it very difficult for counties to outsource different services with nonprofit organizations, whether it's health services or other types of social services. How do you see this playing out? This seems to be generating a lot of opposition, but it's already passed the assembly. You have local assembly members, including Joaquin Arambula, who supported it.
Well, Joaquin Arambula should be ashamed of that. And what that tells me is that the Democratic leaders in Sacramento have basically told him, you can't be independent. If you be independent, if you do what's best for your region on something where we order you to vote yes, you're going to end up in the doghouse.
Sounds like a little different approach than his father.
Well, obviously. And I wrote the editorial that was in the Bee, and I called this one of the worst turkeys ever cooked up by the Democrats in Sacramento. And it would hurt nonprofits, not just in the Valley, but throughout California. And when you see the names of the respected nonprofits that are saying, this will close us down, everybody ought to be worried about it.
Bill McEwen is the new news director at GVWire.com. After 37 years with the Fresno Bee, he is now in that new role. You'll find your videos and editorials on the website. What do you have coming up, if you can just tell us briefly? What should we look for?
So, Joe, you asked me today about Brooke Ashton. I'll be interviewing him about an hour from now, and that'll be the basis of a column. In addition, I'll have a column later this week on an alternative to the homeless situation that's been very successful in Austin, Texas. And people in Fresno ought to be thinking about that instead of passing anti-camping ordinances. David Taub got inside the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C., so we're going to give you a video tour of that, and we have some work to do to make that high-quality video, but we hope to have that up on Friday. You can see it throughout the weekend, and it's real simple. It's gvwire.com.
Bill McEwen, a news director at GV Wire, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me today, Joe.
And stay with us. We'll be back in a little bit and hear from violinist Patrick Contreras joining us in studio to talk about his new band and upcoming performances. Also find out why Valley farmers are feeling a pinch in their pockets as the new crop report in Fresno County is out. We'll find out why the county took a multi-million dollar hit with an interview with Ezra David Romero that's coming up in just a bit here on FM 89. This is Valley Edition. Across the San Joaquin Valley, harvest is in full swing. Almonds are being shaken off trees, peaches are carefully packaged, and melons are being plucked from fields. Every year, the total value of all the agricultural goods in Fresno County is measured, and the data is released in what's called a crop report. It's a big way the county measures how productive its farm economy is. In this interview, FM 89's Ezra David Romero chats with Fresno County Agricultural Commissioner Les Wright about how the county's total value of agricultural goods dropped last year by $482 million when compared with 2015.
Well, thanks for joining me, Les.
Yep.
So first of all, explain what a crop report is and what does it mean to the county?
Well, every county is required by law to submit a report annually conditions within its county, and that includes our crop values. Everybody really looks at the big number, but the real value of the crop report is in the details within the report. It shows trends, yields, trends of yields and prices over time if you compare it to previous reports. And it's used by bankers and insurance companies and government agencies to predict what banks want to invest their lender dollars into, how insurance companies need to have a reserve in case of catastrophic disaster. And government agencies look at it for the purposes of placing their branch offices to service the ag industry. And there's other uses within that, but that's what the real meat of the report is the details.
Gotcha. So let's get to some of those details. How did Fresno County fare last year overall?
Overall, we were at $6.18 billion, which was down about 7.23%. For the most part, it was due to less than stellar markets. Almost every category of crops declined, mainly because of pricing. If you take almonds for an example, their price was about half the year before, and vegetable crops took a real hard hit this year, not only in Fresno County, but statewide. With a couple of exceptions, nursery stock increase and apiary increase, just pollinator value alone increased by $22 million in 2016 over 2015.
So what are the reasons for this drop? Has some kind of like bubble burst?
A lot of things affect the value of a crop, and production is, of course, probably number one, production versus demand. And then other factors like the price of the dollar on the world market for export. If the dollar is higher value, that means that a foreign country or businesses within a foreign country can't buy as much product for the same dollar that they did if the dollar was of lower value. So there's a lot of things that goes on.
How did drought or weather affect the outcome of these crops?
Well, I'm hoping that this is the bottom. Fresno County, because of the drought, and this was the third consecutive year of zero surface water allotment for the west side, plus the east side had no surface water allotment. We had nearly 280,000 acres out of production. I'm hoping that this is the bottom. But if you compare 2016 to 2015, there wasn't much difference in water allotment. There wasn't much difference in acreage out of production. So the water shortage itself probably didn't play as much of a role as it did in 2014 and 15.
So what parts of the agricultural world were clear winners in this crop report? Were there some crops that did better, even though there was a slight decline?
Not really. Almonds continued to be our leading commodity. They represent about 19.5% of our total crop value in the county. But with the price drop, if you look at their total value that was reported to us, it wasn't that much difference. And that's because there's a lot of acreage coming in production that, you know, the younger trees coming into production. So the production numbers went up, but the price was down. So clearly a winner was pistachios. Last year in 2015, due to the warm spring and fluctuating temperatures that we had, the dating game got messed up between the pollinator trees and the production trees, and they just didn't bloom at the same time. So last year there was a lot of blanks. It looks like a normal nut, but there's no nut inside. Their production was about half of normal, and this year everything timed out for them. They had a good production year, a normal production year, and so they came back into the top 10 crops list and replace mandarins on that list.
So what are those top 10 crops? Have those changed at all this year?
The top six didn't change from last year. So almonds, grapes, poultry as a category, cattle and calves, tomatoes, and milk all stayed one through six, the same as the year before. However, pistachios jumped into number seven when they were completely out of the top 10 last year. And then garlic, oranges, and peaches round out our top 10.
So we're 8 months into 2017. What do you expect this year? Do you think it's going to be quite a different crop report next year?
Well, I think it will definitely be a different crop report, but the announcement of the allotment to the west side came so late that producers really didn't have the opportunity to plan ahead. Instead of them having the opportunity to get a contract for, say, tomatoes or something of higher value per acre, about the only thing left was cotton. And so we've more than doubled our cotton acreage in 2017 compared to 2016. I'm considering 2017 kind of a transition year because of that. And if we have a fairly normal winter and the allotments for the east side and west side are on normal time frames, the farmers will be able to do a little better planning. And I'm hoping that 2018 brings us back into normal production that we haven't seen in the last 4 or 5 years.
With a slight decline in 2016, moving into 2017, how do you feel like the region's coped with that decline? Has there been a strong hit to the agricultural world? Like, can people feel it?
Oh, definitely. People have felt the effects of the water shortage without those vegetable crops and things that require a lot of water, plus they require a lot of labor. The farm worker community, the little small communities, you know, Mendota and Firebaugh, those other communities that have a lot of farm worker living in their community and spending money, they felt the impact because there was not as much work as there normally is. And then on top of that, with that many acres out of production, your transportation companies, your suppliers, your fertilizer suppliers, they all felt that impact and had reduction in workforce. So yes, there's definitely been an impact due to the water shortage.
Is there anything else that sticks out in the crop report that you want to highlight?
Well, I want to highlight couple of things that are very important. These are reported dollars to us by our growers, and I say dollars, that equates, we equate a dollar value based on yield and price received as reported from the, by us to us from by the growers. And it's gross value. It doesn't take into effect any cost or inputs to that crop, so it is not a net profit or loss, and we've divided up by industries or commodities, so there's no individual profit or loss that you can read into this report. I like to point out when I give this report is, you know, the growers do all the work. All I do is report what they report to me. So the better report returns that I have from my grower community, the more accurate our report can be.
Well, thank you. We've been chatting with Les Wright. He's the Fresno County Agricultural Commissioner. Thanks for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Sounds you hear are from a new project by Fresno violinist Patrick Contreras. It's called El Violin, and Patrick joins us now in the studio to talk about the release of this new EP and also some concerts that are coming up. Patrick, welcome.
you.
Yeah, and this is a project that's a little different in sound than some of the things you've done before.
Right.
Where did the idea for this come from?
Long story short, the seed started about 2-3 years ago. I was down in Texas playing Tejano music, which is traditionally not have a violin in it. So I was kind of exploring that whole genre. I got to tour with a Tejano artist, Jorge Moreno, and we played some festivals down there. One trip, we played in San Antonio at a festival. We had a meeting with the Quintanilla family, which is Selena's family, and which is in Corpus Christi. So we took the drive down to Corpus Christi, and it was cool. We were at the museum and at the studios where, you know, they record. And the father, Abraham, comes down and starts talking to us. And got to go to lunch with him. We were eating this, you know, little hole-in-the-wall fish spot in Corpus Christi, serving red snapper with beans and rice. So good. One of the things he said to me was, one of the reasons why Selena was big, obviously her talent, number one, but also that she had a Mexican-American sound, which is a demographic he felt was not, at the time, was low, being overlooked by the industry. Either you're playing Mexican music, Norteño, heavily with the Mexican influence, or a lot of us are great at copying and learning other people's music. But he said, that demographic's being, when is artists going to rise up and start doing Mexican? When are we going to bring our voice, just like, you know, Detroit, Memphis, Texas, where's our sound? And that seed just sort of developed over the years, and it's always something I've been wanting to do anyway. And so earlier this year, I just made the decision, I'm going to do it. I'm great at being an entertainer. I love to do it. That's never going to change, but I need to start being an artist and paint. If I were to take all my influences, okay, now remove them. What do I sound like? And so this is where this started.
Interesting. So what's the instrumentation like? I mean, is it more pared down because of that? You're saying removing things versus the more Jimi Hendrix style thing that we often see you do, the shredding up there
right,
on stage
right.
with the plugged-in violin?
There's definitely still some shreddage, but it's, okay, so drums. You have drums, bass, guitar, accordion. That's one of the number one differences. And then also I have a backup violin and mandolin, which is actually Eviscal playing up those parts.
Oh, fantastic. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about it some more, but first listen to me. I think it's always better to talk about music
right.
after we listen
right.
to it.
Right.
Let's hear cut 8, the first one that we have loaded up here, Patrick Contreras and his new project, El Violin. Music by Patrick Contreras here. Many artists treat the studio as an instrument itself. What was it like going to record with these musicians? Is it kind of a live project, or is it mixing all this stuff together in the studio and using those advantages?
Great experience. I think recording changed me as a musician. Like I've been to the studio before and I've rushed through it, but I've never not taken the process. I've never, unfortunately, taking the process as seriously as I could. This time I sat down and painted everything. I mean, we listened to this hours and hours of listening back. What textures, what guitar tones, what sounds, what drum beat, how do we want this done? So this was more like a painting and a drawing, and that slowly came together. I had a sound in my head, but capturing that sound, that process, this is the very first track. I recorded this about a year and a half ago at the time I was living in Tower District in my little tiny apartment, and I recorded this little melody. And as I was early this year deciding to move forward with this project, El Violin, or El Violin, however you want to say it, what is this sound? And then I remember that moment that I came up with that little riff. And as you see, it's a little bluesy, it's a little Mexican, it's a little this and that. So the recording studio, right, it's a whole nother monster. And it was allowed me to really sit back and, you know, we've been recording for a while now. So it was a process for sure.
So we have one more track I want to play now, and this is all, again, ahead of this EP release date at Fulton 55 on September 1st. Let's listen to this last one now. Patrick Contreras with us in studio. This is his new EP, El Violin, that is coming out September 1st at Fulton 55. I imagine there's going to be a lot of dancing, especially with a track like that.
Oh, yeah, no. Anybody, you got to come to dance. It's that vibe. I mean, that's one of the heart of Mexican music and Mexican American music is dancing. So,
and that was an interesting piece in that you had sort of this banda, right, you know, oompa thing going on in the bass line and the drums, and yet a very romantic melody over the top of that.
Right. Which was, Matt, I remember waking up and just, I could not sleep one night because I was like, I hear this. And I just like, my wife was next to me, like, what's going on? I was like, I hear this sound, I have to get it out. So like I called Omar Nade this morning, who's another local artist who I was working with that morning. He's an artist who I work with, Omar Nade, and I said, "Dude, I got this idea. We have to go for it." So we slowly. It first started out as this Colombian sort of Colombian cumbia. I was wrestling with, and I was like, "Ah, no. It's too Colombian. I need Mexican." And he actually came with the idea. He's like, "Well, let's listen to some old rancheras and norteño." And I was listening to it, and I was like, yeah, that's it. And so we found it, put it together, arranged it. And so.
So it's coming up September 1st at Fulton 55 in Fresno. How can people get more information?
You can go to the website, www.fulton55.com. You can find my Facebook page, El Violin, El Violin. You can search it. I'm also on Instagram and Twitter, Hijo de Violin.
We'll look forward to it, and I'm sure there will be a lot more coming up. I know you're all over the state these days playing for Silicon Valley parties and
non-stop.
All kinds of things.
Non-stop.
So I have a feeling that something big may be happening in your future, and we're very proud to have you in our studio today again. Patrick Contreras, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That does it for Valley Edition today. As always, let us know what you think. Email us talk@kvpr.org or send us a tweet. We are at KVPR and at Valley Edition. You can also subscribe to our podcast and listen to Valley Edition at any time during the week. If you miss any of our segments, again, that's on kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Ezra David Romero, reporters Carrie Klein and Jeffrey Hess, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation. With a new partnership, you can now find C-section and other maternity care ratings for your local hospital on Yelp.